6:13. This afternoon's title is A Path Toward Compassion and Justice, Deliverance from the Time of Trial. Matthew 6:13, Jesus wraps up his prayer that he's teaching us to pray with, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. There's a historical, political context in which Jesus made this phrase that I think will assist us in helping us understand what Jesus is referring to. I do not believe that Jesus is referring to temptations in general. He wasn't a Puritan. He wasn't a moralistic teacher. He wasn't saying, help us avoid all temptations. It was a specific temptation and a specific time of trial that he was referring to. And if we understand the cultural events of that day, what was taking place around him at that time, this becomes extremely clear, and I hope to do that for you this afternoon. Jesus appeared in, he emerged in Galilee during an era of violent rebellions. The first one was in 4 BCE. It was the Judas Rebellion. Augustus was Caesar in Rome. And it broke out in the town of Sepphoris. The Roman governor in Syria marched in. All throughout Galilee and Judea, this rebellion took place. And the Roman governor in Syria's name was Varus. So he marched his army into the region, and Josephus actually tells us in Antiquities, Josephus' book, Jewish Antiquities, that he turned over part of his army to his son and one of his friends, and then sent them out to fight against the Galileans who inhabit the region adjoining Ptolemais. And his son attacked all who opposed him and routed them. After capturing Sepphoris, he reduced its inhabitants to slavery and the burnt city. He burnt Sepphoris to the ground. This would have been the environment in which Jesus would have grown up in. He would have grown up in the wake of when Rome came in and leveled Sepphoris. Jesus understood what Rome does to those who stand up to it, who rebel. It's actually, talking about Varus, he sent his son to Sepphoris, which is a neighboring village of Nazareth. Matter of fact, some scholars believe Sepphoris was so close to Nazareth that as Jesus grew up as a tradesman, he would have actually worked in Sepphoris, though he lived in Nazareth. That's where he would have found work as a young man doing his trade in the rebuilding of Sepphoris. But the magnitude of the heavy-handedness of Rome, not only did Varus send his son up to level Sepphoris, he marched down into Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem alone, they crucified 2,000 inhabitants of, there were 2,000 crosses on the horizon of these rebels. It was just massive heavy-handed response to these violent rebellions in Judea. Next, we have the Roman-Jewish War of 66 to 69. That was under Nero. Sepphoris, at this point, stayed faithful to Rome. They had a history. They know what happened if they didn't. And out of Sepphoris, Sepphoris became kind of like a center of operations for the Roman legion in Syria. And this was the war that led to the raising of Jerusalem, the wiping out of Jerusalem so that it can no longer be inhabited. This is how Rome responded to violent rebellions. Later, in 132 to 136, we have the Bar Kokhba revolt. And this is what is many historians of that first century, they refer to as the third Jewish revolt. And according to some, there were 580,000 Jews who perished in that rebellion, and that doesn't count the many more who died of hunger and disease. Judeans who survived were sold into slavery. The communities of Judea were so devastated that some scholars from that time period, some historians say it was even more than the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 CE, it was genocide of the Jewish people. It was an era, we have to understand the era of context, the context in which Jesus, he engaged in ministry. This was a time when there were violent rebellions against Rome, and Rome was known for responding to those violent rebellions by just coming in and completely wiping people out. One of the reasons, I think, why Jesus promoted nonviolence is because violence was not a viable option for them if they wanted to survive, to enjoy the liberation, if they should accomplish it. Let's say they do liberate Jerusalem like they did initially. Well, Rome just came in and wiped them out. So it wasn't a legitimate... And we talk about nonviolence. We have to not only look at its success rate, we have to look at the failure rates of both. People say, well, violence sometimes works, but violence doesn't always work. Am I right? And nonviolence sometimes works, but nonviolence doesn't always work. Does that make sense? It's not whether one works or whether one doesn't. You have to also look at their failure rates. When violence doesn't work, what is the magnitude at which it fails? And when nonviolence doesn't work, what is the magnitude at which it fails? Does it fail to a lesser degree than the other failure? So Jesus is actually trying to balance between survival and liberation here, saying, yes, stand up to injustice, but do so in a way that gives you the best possible odds, if you fail, to live another day. Think about within womanist theology, Christian womanist theology, one of the figureheads for womanist theology is Hagar. The slave Hagar. And Hagar liberated herself initially. There was twice she got away from Abraham and Sarah. But she, initially when she liberated herself, she was dying in the wilderness. Her and her child were... And Jesus... Or not Jesus, sorry. God told in the story, God tells Hagar, go back to Abraham and Sarah. Well, what do you mean go back? You're sending her back into servitude? Does God want to liberate Hagar? Absolutely. But he doesn't want to kill Hagar. Yes, it's important to be liberated, but you're dying here. Survival sometimes outweighs liberation. You have to balance the two. And oppressed, marginalized communities live in the tension of survival and liberation, working to liberate, but not to push so hard that we're wiped out. This is the tension we find when Jesus prays this prayer, is a Jewish community who were longing to be liberated from Roman oppression. And some who would take up arms to do so, and the backlash was so great, so you get liberated, but there's only one of you left. What is that about? We also have, in more local to Jesus' time, we have an era of nonviolent protests in Judea. The first one was in 26 CE. Around the time that Jesus would have soon been entering into his ministry, this would have been just previous to the best dates that we have. This would have been just before Jesus embarks on his ministry. This would have been in the recent years leading up to the Jesus story. You had the standards incident where a procurator from of Judea's Tiberius sent Pilate, who during the nights, and I'm reading from Josephus here, secretly undercover, conveyed to Jerusalem the images of Caesar known as standards. So they were going to place in Jerusalem these statues to Caesar. Now, why would the Jewish people be opposed to that? How would they have interpreted those statues to Caesar? What would they would have called them? Idols. These are graven images. I'll read to you just a portion, and I have it there as well in your handout. The Jews, as though by agreement, they fell to the ground in a body, and they bent their necks, shouting that they were ready to be killed rather than transgress the law. What were they doing there? That's nonviolent protest to Rome. Saying, you can kill us, but you're going to have to over our dead bodies to put us. Now, they didn't raise swords, but it was nonviolent protest. The next one would have been after Jesus in 40 CE. You have the statue of Gaius Caligula, where now there was a statue being attempted to be placed, not just in Jerusalem, but in the temple itself. And here's Josephus again. This is what the Jewish people said. On no account would we fight, they said. And they had good reason to not fight. If they fight, what would be the response? On no account would we fight, they said, but we will die sooner than violate our laws. Willing to lay down their lives. Philo writes of this event. When the Jews at large got to know of the scheme, they staged mass demonstrations of protest before Petronius, who by then was in Phoenicia with his army. So this wasn't, Jesus was growing up in an era that looked very much like the political landscape we live in today here in the United States, where everybody's protesting for something. Some of them are violent protests. Some of them are nonviolent protests. And not all nonviolent protests are purely nonviolent. This is the atmosphere in which Jesus teaches us to pray, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the coming evil. There was a political context in which Jesus prayed this prayer. What could he have meant when he said, lead us not into temptation? I believe it had a very specific meaning and not just a general one. And to see it, I think we need to go to Mark. Mark chapter 14, and we're going to read Mark and Matthew from two different versions. In Mark 14:38, we find this passage referring to the night Jesus was arrested. Jesus comes and says, keep awake and pray that you might not come into the, what does it say? Here's that same language we find in the Lord's Prayer. Into the time of trial, the spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. The NIV, it reads this way, watch and pray so that you will not fall into what? Temptation or testing. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Look at Matthew 26:41. Stay awake and pray that you may not come into the, there it is again, what is it called? Spirit is willing, flesh is weak. And then from the NIV, watch and pray so that you will not fall into what? When Jesus was asking them to pray this the night of Jesus' arrest, was he talking about not eating Snickers bars? I mean, what kind of temptation? Was he just like general temptation, just that you'll be able to live a pure life and not, you know, enter into temptation? No. It wasn't a general prayer not to be in temptation. It was a specific prayer not to enter into a specific temptation. And how do we know that? Because they failed that night to continue to pray with him. They did not continue in prayer so as to avoid the temptation. And what was the temptation that they next entered into in the narratives? What do these authors want us to see is this temptation? What is the next event? In Mark 14, 47 through 48, but one of those who stood near drew his what? And struck the slave of the high priest, cutting off his ear. And then Jesus said to them, have I come out with swords and clubs to arrest me? Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as though I were an insurrectionist, one of those violent rebels? Well, let's unpack some of this. Why were they arresting Jesus? What had he done just a few days previous? Yeah, he had walked into, talking about shutting it down. I mean, that was a hashtag on Twitter last year. Shut it down. We get upset at people blocking freeways or bridges. Jesus did not allow anyone to enter into or to pass out of the temple that day. He shut the whole temple down. I find it fascinating that in Mark 11:11, Jesus comes in into what we call the triumphal entry, which is kind of a misnomer because there wasn't anything triumphal about it. But Jesus enters into Jerusalem on the first day of the week. And it says that as he entered in Jerusalem, and when he comes in on the foal of a donkey, and he went into the temple courts and he looked around at everything. But since it was already what? Late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. In other words, he walks into the temple that evening after his entry into Jerusalem on that donkey, which is kind of an interesting parable in itself. Most military marches, you're riding a war steed. And here comes this Messiah riding a donkey. That itself hints to us that this revolution is going to come through different methods. But he walks into the temple, and I would submit to you, I see this saying that Jesus is coming into the temple immediately off of the back of that donkey to cleanse the temple that night, to engage in his temple protest and his demonstration that night. But he walks in and he looks around, and what's the problem? If a demonstration is going to be successful, what do you have to have? You have to have a crowd. You have to have people there to see it. Or it's pointless. So he walks in and there's no one there. So what does he do? He goes back to Bethany. Now who lived in Bethany? Mary, Martha, Lazarus. He goes back to his friend's house. He spends the night there with friends. This is not, I know what Rembrandt painted. Jesus didn't walk into the temple and lose his cool. He didn't lose his temper. This was intentional. This was purposeful. This was by his design. Jesus actually went back to Bethany that night and had a good night's sleep on it. And then chose the next morning to come back when he knew it would be packed with people. And he comes in and he overturns the tables. And he shuts the whole thing down. What's the time of test? What is the temptation? They've come to arrest Jesus for what he had been doing in the temple that week. And when they show up with their clubs and with their swords, what's the temptation? Lead us not into the time of testing, the time of trial, the temptation to respond to violence and injustice with more violence. But deliver us from because violence escalates, does it not? Now, I want to be also very clear. Let me just pause right here. If you're waiting for the perfect protest, you'll never engage. In 1967, 74% of Americans opposed Dr. Martin Luther King's march on Washington, a nonviolent march. What's the percentage? Most people believe that MLK was hurting the civil rights movement, not helping it.
Making waves.
And yet today he's held up as the quintessential example of how to protest. That is not what the story was at the time. Some of you are old enough to remember how hated MLK was. And how we have a national holiday now that celebrates him as an American when the FBI said he was the most dangerous threat to America during his time in 1968. It's easier to domesticate and to honor those in our past than it is to engage the changes that they lived and died to work toward. Today, nonviolence is usually pulled. Every time there's a protest, MLK is pulled off the shelf and used to try to quiet the masses. Anybody notice that? Settle down. That is a co-opting of King's memory, King's mission. We'll talk about King more before we're done because I think it's relevant to this. Jesus came in, he shut the whole temple down, and maybe some of us aren't used to thinking of Jesus this way, but Jesus was engaged in protest activism, active protest against the political, religious, economic, and social exploitation that was taking place in his culture at which the temple had become the center. He could have stayed in Galilee and just kept doing what he was doing. No, in Mark, he purposely leaves Galilee and comes to Jerusalem. His march to Jerusalem, that's the center. That's where it's all stemming from. That's where he's got to stage his demonstration. He gets arrested, Matthew 26, 51 through 52. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, coveting off his ear. How does Jesus respond? Put your sword back in its what? For Jesus said to him, for all who draw the sword will what? In Jesus' context, that statement makes perfect sense. He is not some wise philosopher here. He's just telling you how things worked back then. If you try to rebel with the sword, what happens? You have Sepphoris, you have Jerusalem, those who live by the sword, those who try to liberate themselves by the sword. In that context, you're going to die by the sword. No more of this, he says. Luke says the same thing. One of the followers pulled out a sword. This time in Luke, they actually ask first, Lord, should we strike with our swords? Those are the ones Jesus told them to go and buy, by the way. One of them didn't wait for the answer. One of them struck the high priest, cutting off his right ear. And by the way, I think in this story, we got robbed of one of the greatest miracle stories that could have been in the Jesus story. And that's because the only reason he cut off his ear, he wasn't like Zorro. You know what I mean? Sometimes we picture things so weird. It wasn't like Peter was skilled at cutting off just that dude's ear. You know, it's kind of like a fillet of ear. It's not how it worked. Peter was impetuous in the stories. Peter's aiming for the guy's head. And the guy ducks. And that's why it glances off and just takes off his ear. That would have been a cool miracle. Had the guy not ducked. So I say we got robbed. That would have been a cool story. Jesus didn't heal his ear. He picks the dude's head up and puts it back on. In all seriousness, even the Gospel of John, which is the most unearthly gospel of them all, has Jesus saying, put your sword away. They had failed to watch and pray that they might not enter into the temptation. And when the time of crisis came, they failed. And this wasn't offensively trying to bring about the changes Jesus was casting before their imagination. This was defensively. They were just trying to defend themselves. Yeah, defend the innocent person. There's a lot here to chew on. I'm thankful for Barbara Deming's work, her book, Revolution and Equilibrium. She writes, with one hand, we say to the one who is angry or to an oppressor or to an unjust system, stop what you are doing. I refuse to honor the role that you are choosing to play. I refuse to obey you. I refuse to cooperate with your demands. I refuse to build the walls and the bombs. That was written in 1976. It could have been written yesterday. I refuse to pay for the guns. With this hand, I will interfere with the wrong that you are doing. I want to disrupt the easy pattern of your life. This is what upset the powers that be, the elites in Jerusalem, so badly. Jesus upset the easy pattern of their life. He disrupted their everyday events. But, she says, then the advocate of nonviolence raises the other hand. And it is outstretched, maybe with love and sympathy, but maybe not. Always outstretched. With this hand we say, and this is so important, I will not let go of you or cast you out of the human race. I have faith that you can make a better choice. A better choice than you are making now, and I'll be there when you're ready, like it or not. We're part of one another. Again, our friends are not infallible and our enemies are not disposable. We are part of one another. Yes, Jesus calls us to say no to injustice. How many have seen that in the Lord's Prayer this weekend? Enough food for everyone. Canceling of debts. Setting in motion a radical sharing and redistribution of Earth's resources, a just distribution. And as exciting as that sounds, Jesus ends by saying, but we cannot do it with the sword. Because if you take this and with the sword, just invert it, it won't be long before it's right back in the same shape again. Jesus sought to take this and to transform it into a shared table. And you can't do that at the tip of a sword. There's also another element in this prayer of avoidance. We're praying to avoid the time of trial, avoid the time of evil, the crisis that's coming. To avoid the cross entirely. Now, what I'm going to say may sound iffy, but I'm asking you to just at least hear me out. Give it a chance first. Following Jesus does not intrinsically involve a cross. Let me say it again. Following Jesus does not intrinsically involve a cross. Jesus isn't calling us to death. Jesus is calling us to life. When does it involve a cross? When those threatened by the changes Jesus came to make threaten you with a cross if you don't shut up, sit back down, and be quiet. Then following Jesus involves a cross. That's a subtle distinction. It's a distinction that I think needs to be made. Let's talk about domestic violence for just a moment. Typically, we have abuse. And when let's talk about a woman who's being abused for a moment. A woman goes to her pastor and says, well, what should I do? And historically, more times than not, the majority of times, pastors have told women in this scenario to be like Jesus and to bear their cross. Am I making this up? What does that mean? Well, what it means is the abuse itself is equated with the cross, and you can either patiently endure it or you can resist it. And too often being Christ-like for women has been defined as which one of those two, the left or the right? Patiently enduring. Just bear your cross. I'm going to submit to you that whenever we see abuse or injustice, this is not the cross that Jesus asks us to roll over and bear. We could patiently endure, or we can resist. And when you resist, those who feel threatened by that resistance will threaten you with a cross to try to motivate you to sit back down, to shut up, to be silent, to just put up with the injustice. And Jesus is at this point, you have to be willing to bear the cross. You cannot allow injustice to go unresisted. How many see that in a little different light right now? Because turning the other cheek, and I've talked about this every time I've been here of late, turning the other cheek was a form of resistance. If you're going to have to hit me, if you're not familiar with this, check it out online. I don't know if I gave you a link. Go to our website, email me, I'll send you the presentation. If you're going to hit me, that's fine, but you're going to have to do it on the proper cheek as your social equal. It was resistance. Taking off the Walter Wink is where most of this comes from. If you taking off the one garment when they're suing you for the other, you're standing there stark naked in the town square as if to say, shame on you. You're shaming the entire system. Going 2 miles instead of the one, you're refusing to play by your oppressor's rules. There's resistance in all of those nonviolent forms. In a world where yourself is already being sacrificed by those above you in the cone, by your oppressors, by those who marginalize you, Jesus' message to the oppressed and the disenfranchised is not more self-sacrifice. It's a way to reclaim the self that's being denied and oppressed and marginalized. It's a way to affirm their self and stand up and resist. And when that takes place, yes, more often than not, a cross will be threatened. You want to resist? This is what's going to happen to you if you keep doing what you're doing. Let me tell you, I know something about what it means to bear a cross. I know something about what it means to be told to stop saying the kind of things that you're saying, or you're going to be sorry. And Jesus would say, when change threatens those in positions of power, don't be silent. Keep speaking up, because the servant is not greater than the master. And that's horribly problematic language. But I believe what Jesus was trying to say is the teacher is not different than the student. If they did it to me, they're going to do it to you anyway. Stand up anyway. Don't be silent. Speak up anyway. We can pray that it doesn't come to this. Amen? Wouldn't it be nice that it doesn't come to this? And this is what he's saying. Pray that you would not be led, that you pray that we would not be led into temptation, like the night in the garden, where they failed to pray and they met that temptation, but that you would be delivered from the time of crisis, the time of evil, that you'd be delivered from the cross. This is not a martyrdom love for dying. This is not a martyr complex. We're to pray, yes, help us not be violent, and at the same time, help us not to succumb to their violence. Help us not to be silenced by theirs. In Charlottesville, I have friends, clergy friends, who were there that day, who I have spoken to since, who literally looked in the eyes of those whom they were resisting and feared, though they had been trained in nonviolent tactics, they feared for their life that day. They thought this was it. Joan Carlson Brown and Rebecca Parker wrote an essay called God So Loved the World. If you haven't read it, you can Google it and find it. It is phenomenal. They are feminist theologians, feminist scholars. And they write, it is not the acceptance of suffering that gives life. It is the commitment to life that gives life. The question, moreover, is not, am I willing to suffer? The question is, do I desire to fully live? This distinction is subtle and to some spacious, but in the end, it makes a great difference in how people interpret and respond to suffering. If you believe that the acceptance of suffering gives life, well, that's that patient endurance. Are you with me? Then your resources for confronting perpetrators of violence and abuse will be numbed. When Jesus says, take up your cross, those who find their life will lose it, and those who are willing to lose their life will find it. What he's saying is, if you live at the price of remaining silent, that's just like what MLK said, that's the day you really stop living. Yeah, you're alive, you're still breathing, but you're dead. It's the paradox. Those who refuse to let go of their hold on life and they resist, even if threatened with a cross, those are the ones that are truly living. I reject fundamentally a form of nonviolence that teaches the myth of redemptive suffering. Jesus does not call us to die. Sometimes nonviolence is defined, and this is the point I was trying to make earlier, as patiently enduring injustice. That's when MLK is taken off the shelf and nonviolence is lifted up just to get people to go back to patiently, quietly enduring. If you're going to protest, fine, but do it in a way that doesn't change anything. Have you seen that happen before? Do it in a way that, you know, everything just continues on as business as usual. That's the myth of redemptive suffering, that if you suffer, it's through your suffering things will change. Jesus says, no, the subtle difference. Resist even if threatened with a cross. What are some strategies for change? Looking at the Lord's Prayer here, that we not come into, that, that would be not, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one, or the time of crisis, or the time of evil. What are some strategies for change? Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., this is in 1968, the year he was assassinated, the other or murdered, the year that he was killed. From his speech, The Other America, he writes, "I think America must see that riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society which must be condemned and vigorously, as vigorously as we condemn riots." Too often we find today those who condemn the riots but fail to condemn that which led to the riots. Have you noticed that? We're more concerned with keeping the peace than we are with making peace. Yeah. By the way, Jesus' nonviolent protest in the temple involved some property damage. We're going to have to let that confront us. It was not personal property. It was private property. There's a difference between the two. But in the final analysis, a riot, he says, is the language of the unheard. What is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years. It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met. It has failed to hear that the large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, equality, and humanity. Do you hear what he's saying there? More concerned about peace than justice. And so in a real sense, our nation's summers of riots are caused by our nation's winters of delay. And as long as America postpones justice, we stand in a position of having these recurrences of violence and riots over and over again. Social justice and progress are the absolute guarantors of riot prevention. If you don't want to riot, then prevent them by listening. JFK said, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." That's the difference between peacekeeping and peacemaking. MLK, again, "There was a time when the church was very powerful," King said, "in the time when the early Christians rejoiced at being deemed worthy to suffer for what they believed. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas and principles of a popular opinion. It was a thermostat that transformed the mores of society. Whenever the early Christians entered a town, the people in power became disturbed and immediately sought for they sought to convict the Christians for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators." Read the book of Acts. It's in there. Peacekeeping would say, just sit down and be silent. Peacemaking says, no, let's have that distributive justice, the just distribution of God's earth for God's people, for everyone, so that there is no more violence. It's that two-hand approach where we say, stop. Those whom you're oppressing, those at the bottom of the triangle and the margins of the edges of the circle, those people are human. They are worthy. Black, Latinx, Native, Arab, Asian, Jewish, Muslim, immigrant communities, women, our LGBTQ siblings, and the organizations of the working class who are engaging the work of opposition to the white male agenda of power. They are human. They are worthy. Pastor Martin, German Lutheran pastor, writes this famous poem. "First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. Today, if that was to be rewritten in our time, that was a German Lutheran pastor writing in the context of Nazi Germany. But if we were to rewrite this poem in our day and age, in our climate, in our social political context, we could say, first they came for the poor and the working class. First they came for people of color, specifically black and brown people. They came for women. They came for Latinx, Native, Arab, and Asian people. They came for our Muslim siblings. They came for our immigrant communities. They even came for our lesbian, gay, bisexual. They came for our transgender citizens, our gender nonconforming people. An Adventist could say, and then they came for me, a Sabbatarian. But there was no one left to speak for me. It's a call to say, stop. They are human. They are worthy. And it's also a call to hold on to the humanity of those that you're saying stop to. They too are human. And though you say to them that you will stop them, that at the same time you say that you will not cast them out of the human race. They are not permitted to proceed, but that you'll be there when they're ready to change. This is the prayer. Do not lead us into temptation. The temptation to objectify our enemies, to believe that our enemies are disposable, to dehumanize our enemies as well as the victims, to not be led down the path of escalating violence, but to lead us towards liberation, deliverance from evil, liberation toward a new day, liberation from social, political, economic, racial, sexist, personal, societal, and systemic evil. This is what I hear the Lord's Prayer saying to us today in our context. Our Father in heaven, may your name be hallowed. May your kingdom come among us here. May your will be done here on earth as it is in heaven. And may everyone today have enough food to eat. May the earth's resources, may God's earth be justly distributed to all of God's children as the great householder. May our debts be canceled as we cancel the indebtedness of those who are indebted to us. A massive redistribution of the earth's resources that have been hoarded and loaned at interest. And lead us not into the temptation of dehumanizing our enemies nor the victims, but liberate us from the evil of injustice. I'm hoping that at the end of this third presentation, that you're at bare minimum beginning to see some new dimensions to the Lord's Prayer. This prayer was much less about how we got to heaven in the future and more how we liberate ourselves and others from the hell that we're living in today. Any questions, discussions, anything you'd like to share that stuck out, something that was impressed upon you this afternoon that you say, wow, that really spoke to me, or any questions that you have about anything that was shared?